Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast, a podcast where we talk about the martial arts, focusing on Kenpo. I am Reggie Darden, and my wonderful guest today is Sasha Williams, and we're just going to, you know, hear about his journey and whatever other topics that we happen to come across, we will get to. Just kind of a brief rundown of my history. I started Kenpo in the mid 90s. Since then, I've done some Taekwondo, a little bit of Hapkido, and a little bit of boxing. Primarily been doing Capoeira for coming up on 17 years now. And then I rejoined the Kenpo world 2-3 years ago. And as of this recording, still freshly green belted. I'm just enjoying the journey. I got dominating circles in my last class, so looking forward to the next one, which I believe is Twist of Fate. I think is the next technique on the list for me, so I'm excited for that. But yeah, just really enjoying the journey, and now having this podcast, hearing everyone's stories, and so yeah, I'm real excited to hear your story, and go ahead and fill us in on how you got started in the martial arts and how Kenpo found you and how that experience has been for you.
All right. So first of all, a lot of people that see my name, they don't know how to pronounce it at first. My first name is Sasha. Sasha, right? That's confusing because the way it's spelled in my case. Mm-hmm. That's because I'm half German. Okay. And in Germany, just imagine my name being spelled without the letter C in it.
Gotcha.
That would make it much easier to pronounce, wouldn't it? Sasha.
It sure would. Sure would. Thank
you for
that.
The exact same sound in German is spelled with an SCH.
Excellent. Right? I like it.
Right now, that's not a German word at all. It's actually a Russian abbreviation for the name Alexander. Technically, my first name is Alexander. But it's like one of those kids. My parents give me one name, I'd call me by a different name. So they always call me Sasha. So I think, oh, that's my name. That is actually how the Russians abbreviate the name Alexander. Even though I'm not Russian, nobody in my family is, but that's where that came from, right? And there was a famous singer back in Europe right around the time when I was a kid called Sasha Distel. So the name was popular back then, right? It was the early 60s, so that was a time to go, to be a little bit more colorful with your naming of your kids.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there's not more Elvises here.
That's right. So anyhow, that's where I grew up, right? And back in the 60s, I was born in 1962, right? The martial arts was still just kind of getting its foothold, barely starting in the Western world, Europe as well as the United States, right? So the exposure to martial arts was really primarily in Europe, David Carradine and Bruce Lee. That was essentially it. Over here, you had the Billy Jack movies. They never really made it to Germany, but every Thursday I watched, Kung Fu with David Carradine religiously. I thought it was just the most awesomest thing ever.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
But in terms of what was actually starting to become available during that time, you can see that if you look at any kind of old, Black Belt magazine, if there's still some of those around, I think they started in the 60s or late or early. If you look in the back where all the books for sale are advertised that you can buy, every book being sold would have been a judo book.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the first art, probably in large part because of the American GIs bringing it back over to the United States first, right? So that was really the first martial art that was relatively widely available in Europe and also here in the United States, right? And so I never went to an actual judo school, but I worked out with a buddy of mine that was part of an actual judo school, right? Okay. And so I got myself a judo book and studied it and everything, right? So that's, I think I was like 10 or 11 when that happened, right? And, Then I continued to just look at literature that was available, but again, there really wasn't that much yet, right? So my intense martial arts training really started when I moved to the United States. That was in 1978, I think, 78 or 79, I forget right now, right? Mm-hmm. Came over here and had the opportunity to study Kenpo. I didn't really know what it was yet. The place where I started studying was actually in Santa Cruz, California, under one of Mr. Parker's first generation black belts, not very well known, Douglas Gavin McLeod.
Okay.
Very good street fighter. Not a great representative for proper conduct in the martial arts. He would literally intentionally get into fights, hang out in like nightclubs and that kind of stuff. So, during that time, that wasn't that unusual. But yeah. if you look at the honest history of a lot of early martial arts in the United States, it was a little bit more crude, let's say, than what it is nowadays, right?
Yeah, that's my story with, I had always been a fan of the martial arts, and I had begged my father to let me, get started. And he never would, or at least it took about 15 years for me to wear him down. But his story was that, and I can't confirm this, internet, don't beat me up, but he claimed that he used to be a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali. And he said that, kind of during that time, just as you mentioned, the martial arts were just, really starting kind of to gain popularity in the United States and, everywhere else. And he said that the other guards would talk about, I'm learning this karate stuff and I can like rip a man's heart out and, kill him with one blow and all of these sorts of things. So that put a bad taste in my father's mouth about martial arts. So it took years of incessant begging for him to finally let me start training. So.
Well, I guess in that respect, we've come a long ways, right?
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of people don't realize it, but our school, I used to run like four campus schools throughout the 90s, for example. Right? Now, I don't even run a school at all anymore, but we have one. Right? We have one in Fresno, California. It's very large. It's the largest school probably in the area. But my son, Randy, is the one who actually operates that school. But if you truly want to be successful in martial arts commercially, you better be good with teaching children. And that's something I've always naturally been very good with. And we have a very nice family-oriented program. But that, of course, means that you stress different benefits of martial arts. Mm-hmm. The average soccer mom is going to have the exact same reservation that your father had. Yeah. Right. And even though it's no longer as crazy as ripping the heart out, right? It's like, what a weird thing to think about anyhow and to claim of your instructor. My first thought is, how do you guys practice that? How do you know it's
yeah,
working?
Exactly. But
you know, that sensational aspect of martial arts, right? That was really bad in the 70s, even the 80s a little bit, right? But that has now largely been replaced. I think most parents nowadays will easily accept that martial arts has a lot of benefits for people growing up, for children growing up. Right. And the whole point is actually that the true goal of becoming a black belt is not thinking that you're invincible. The true goal should be and usually is that the fear gets removed and you can function more at your natural best under stress. And in a situation where most people would probably lose self-control, most martial artists, if they truly are good martial artists, will be able to maintain their cool, which means they're not driven by fear. Right? They can maintain control over the situation, right? And that's a real plus. You know, if you think of back when you were a child and maybe you had an encounter with the bully, most kids fall out of the sky at that moment. In other words, they had never thought they're naive and they never thought that they would have to deal with something like that. And it really affects them for the rest of their life in many situations, right? And so to me, that almost seems like we're setting children up for failure if they're not to some degree prepared to deal with that, right? And that can be done in a way that parents will agree with, that is completely aligned with standard parenting priorities. Right. So, and that's what our school focuses on. We're a family oriented school. Right. So, we might have mom or even grandpa study side by side with their 5-year-old child that is taking classes, and they're taking part in the same class, same time, same time slot. So, which would have been unheard of in the 70s. And it's not very common in Kempo, since Kempo is so, practicality oriented. Right. So, I have a split personality between being the Kempo black belt, representing Ed Parker's Kempo. I mean, I bleed Ed Parker's Kempo, right? But on the other hand, talking about human development, which is not about effectiveness of the technique, right?
Exactly.
So that kind of explains a little bit where I come from, right? My background was definitely just from what, like, just probably similar to you, it's the fascination of the art. If you think about it, like, I've trained police officers before, lots of martial arts school owners have done that, at least to some degree, and you kind of get disabused of that after a while because most cops will not practice anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a criticism of cops. It is just a reflection of, if, let's say, I don't know, 2% of the population is fascinated by martial arts and will, you know, commit their life to practicing that, right? It's roughly also 2% of cops who will do that.
Exactly.
That's all it is, right? So you don't get the cop being, you know, thinking, oh, you know what, I'm going to start practicing these techniques every day. Plus, it wouldn't be practical anyhow. You know, there's so many other things a cop will use in order to control a situation. They don't really use that much hand-to-hand combat. That, you know, that was my background, looking at the movies first and then having opportunity to eventually study, which was also, by the way, I heard that, that your background, as well as when you interviewed Jamie Seabrook, right? Same thing with me, a mixture between Ed Parker's Kempo and Tracy's Kempo.
Okay.
Extremely common back then, simply because the Tracys spread out first. Mm-hmm. When they left Ed Parker, right, you probably know their story, they were going to actually study law. That was their goal. They were going to become lawyers, right? And in order to finance their, you know, their college tuition, they opened the Kempo school. And they did it so well. Well, back then, you know, it's like that was the only thing, only game in town, right? But they did it so systematically and in a way that it could be duplicated so easily that they just figured, you know, this is better. We're making more money with this. This is something that we're doing well. We're being successful. So they continued that, right? And so at first, especially during the 70s, Tracy's Kempo was much more widespread in the United States than Ed Parker's Kempo was, right? And then that changed when Mr. Parker started writing all these books, right? And that really, the books really didn't come out until the 80s, right? So I sometimes feel, you know, I'm very grateful towards the earlier generations of, you know, people that studied with Mr. Parker before I did. I sort of had I'm in a unique situation and I had a unique benefit because I studied with him most heavily between 1985 until he passed away in 1990. Before I ever took a lesson with him, I already was a black belt, right? But, you know, I owned a school since 1984. I ran a school in Salinas, California. And that was a really good, you know, entry ticket to get taught directly by Ed Parker, right? That was valuable for him, man. So, but the, when Mr. Parker started, doing all these books, some of the old timers started probably getting a little bit nervous because even though they've been around, like possibly in the 60s, for example, right, they didn't have the benefit that I had in the 80s, right? The journals were, already complete. He was updating a new set of journals. He had all the infinite insights into Kempo already printed up, right? So, and I was an avid reader. I love reading. So when those books came out, I mean, I memorized them. So that was great. But it did catch some people off guard. Imagine being with Mr. Parker and, I don't know, until 1975, and then you move to the East Coast to open a school. And then 10 years later, you find out that he did a lot more and continued on developing the system and changed things and printed up more stuff. And you should have continued your lessons, right? And back then, it wasn't like it is now, as you probably still remember, you're old enough, that, well, we couldn't be on video like we are right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It was not available. Right? So it would be, can you have money for a plane ticket?
Right? Exactly.
Right? And even then, how often are you going to be able to do that, right? So I came into Kempo, I think, at a really, really good time because I had those benefits, besides the fact that I live in the same state as Mr. Parker did, right? So it was like a four-hour drive from where I'm at, right? That was very beneficial. But I studied first in Santa Cruz, California, with Douglas McLeod. It was a really good experience. It was a very intense school in terms of really making sure your strikes worked, right? Yeah, the one thing that I think we have to be aware of in Kempo, because I did hear you mention that you also are doing the podcast in part to unite Kempomoa, which I think you will probably achieve, right? It's an inevitable consequence if you are neutral the way you are, and if you conduct yourself as, you know, somewhat as a, you know, a venue where people can get together and be accepted for the ideas that they share, right? And well, one of the things that I think is at the core of that is that we need to work together on making sure that Kempo can survive, right? And that's a subject, I don't want to go too much off subject right here, but there is a common issue that we all have in Kempo, I think, from my view anyhow. You can see in everybody's journey through Kempo, the same development that we saw throughout the decades when Kempo was introduced here in the United States. Meaning, what's your first reaction when you see a Kempo person if you've never seen it before? And then if you start studying it, how do you view that same system 5 years later, and how do you view it maybe 10 or 20 years later, right? Because that changes, right?
Yeah.
And for a beginner, especially back then when there was no other martial arts around, I think the most impressive thing about Kempo was how many times we can hit our opponent in very little time, you know, and in a variety of targets that were previously never even considered being targets. Right? Exactly. Prior to the martial arts, we had boxing or wrestling, right? We never even thought of kicking someone, you know, kicking somebody in the kneecap, right? Or, you know, right? So, or if, then it was considered a cheap shot and you shouldn't be doing it, right? So Kempo was the first system who literally kind of introduced not just the United States, but the world to this idea of, you know what, we can have a great variety of different strikes, inward, outward, upward, downward, right? We can hit the opponent in a great variety of different targets, and we can do it multiple times in a row. We can have long sequences that are just like a machine gun in a way, right? Mm-hmm. And that was probably the first thing that really impressed people, especially if they saw it Parker, right? Because he could do it with speed and power.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not the main strategic advantage that Kempo offers. It is an important aspect of the strategic advantage, but it's not enough. And it's actually what could cause Kempo's downfall. Because the problem with, and Mr. Parker addresses, you've read The Infinite Insights into Kempo?
It's still working on those.
Okay.
No, I haven't got through them yet.
But, okay, well, if you're reading through the first volume, which is smaller and more, you know, not as technical, he talks a lot about his relationship that he had with Bruce Lee, right? And that the two had a slightly different view of how to train in the martial arts. Bruce Lee had the approach of having no patterns, no preset patterns, right? Absorb what is useful. That was one of his famous quotes, absorb what is useful. And Mr. Parker's counter to that was, okay, but to get started, that doesn't work. You have to have a pattern you have to follow. And Mr. Parker, in The Infinite Insights into Kempo, he makes an example of a construction worker. There's a picture, a drawn picture. I think Edmund might have drawn it. A construction worker with a helmet on, you know, those plastic helmets that they wear, right? Mm-hmm. And coming home because he wanted to play the piano, so he would come home and hit the keys for 8 hours. He didn't play music. He just hit the keys, right? So he was at the point Mr. Parker was making, extremely hard worker, but without a system to follow, all that effort was completely in vain. Well, that can happen in Kempo very easily as well, right? And so Bruce Lee and Ed Parker had this discussion about this, right? Bruce Lee already had traditional training, though. So he was almost like you could compare him to a person who had studied a few different martial arts and then said, I'm going to take everything that I've learned so far and now learn to freestyle with it more and use what is most useful at a time. For him at that stage, it made sense. For a white belt starting out, it does not make sense because what do you mean absorb what is useful? What do I practice on? Yeah, So we have preset techniques, obviously, right? You're memorizing all those techniques in Kempo, right? You just were talking about the green belt, the brown belt techniques you're working on right now, right? So the issue is that, in my view, we have a perception problem in Kempo. Right? We do now. Back when, you know, in the 80s we didn't, and when The Perfect Weapon came out, that was awesome, right? And it really showed Kempo in a good light, right? I think Jeff Speakman did a really good, you know, job with that, right? But the problem that we have with memorized technique sequences and doing the strikes on partners is that it doesn't train the perception all that much. It takes the stimulus away from each strike. Excuse me, I have a little cat right here that wants
Oh,
to
no
play with
problem.
my charge coin.
No problem.
So let's say you're doing five swords, right? Against the right Varnal spines, right? Well, you should assume with every technique that after your opponent throws a first punch, he will immediately throw the second punch. And every Ed Parker technique is designed to deal with that, right? In five swords, it's actually, you know, the check at first, you got to protect your face, or, you know, with your rear hand, so that way the guy can't just knock you out with the other, you know, with his left punch, right? But when he's attempting to throw a left punch, he's walking into our hand sword. So the hand sword is more than just, look, there is an available target and I can hit it very quickly. The hand sword is, there's a stimulus that I need to take care of. And because he's coming in with the second strike, that's why my hand sword is a superior strike. You could go and just do a rear hand punch. That's more forceful. But then you're punching him while he's punching you.
Yeah.
Right? So Mr. Parker designed the techniques with one idea in mind that most people are actually somewhat unaware of. And that is highest probability of success. Highest probability of success. In other words, we always have to consider that the opponent is still fighting. Every step of a technique, he's still fighting us back, right? So most people will understand in Kenpo. Most people that have studied Kenpo to at least your level, somewhere, let's say blue belt or green belt, you know, something like that, maybe brown belt, they will usually understand the concept of striking in a way that it checks the opponent, meaning that it prevents the opponent from doing whatever is available to them, right? But it's not done nearly enough. So we do get criticized. If you think of you listen to the criticism that we in the Kenpo community receive from people that maybe mix Kenpo with other martial arts or just come from another martial art, they will criticize us for two things usually. One is our strikes are too weak. That's really just, I mean, with some people that's true. But in general, that's just a misunderstanding of how we develop power, right? For example, many people don't understand the proper body alignment, the proper timing, not realizing that, yeah, our travel is shorter, but there's much more backup mass behind it. So that's just more of a challenge of how are we going to demonstrate that to the public? It's hard, right?
You have to really be good. Very much so.
But the other misconception, or the other criticism, I should say, is that, well, your Kenpo only works if your partner cooperates. And that's kind of our fault for not showing how, you know, the techniques will take care of the second strike and third strike. And again, that's it's a logistically difficult thing to do because, you know, in class, are you really going to keep on always running into your partner with the second punch every time he does five swords on you? You know you're going to walk right into his next strike. So after a while, you kind of say, okay, I give. I know that I'm not going to succeed with my second punch. So why even do it? And we get into that habit, right?
Yeah.
And then that's what people observe. And then they go, oh, that doesn't work. That only works because the guy is stopping. You know, it's a statement that comes from ignorance, but it's a self-imposed ignorance. It's ignorance imposed by us, right? We are not that good at showing how Kenpo takes care of those things, right? And so that is, you know, an issue that I think we all can work on quite a bit more in order to unite as a Kenpo group. Because what are we uniting for? I would suggest the first thing we should unite for is not just to have friends, but is to survive and help Mr. Parker's system to survive, right? And so that means we need to affect public opinion. So now I don't know how I got to hear from studying under Douglas McLeod.
No, I like it. I like that perspective. I think in the Kenpo community and outside, there is, you know, those criticisms, you know, coming from, you know, not understanding what, not putting those things out for people to understand. And, you know, there are different reasons for, you know, kind of not showing all of our cards, so to speak. But yeah, I think that's important, you know, inner reflection that we need to do versus just fighting, oh, well, you know, Ed Parker said we should do it this way, and no, we should do it this way, or no, we should have these many techniques. Like, let's not waste time on that stuff. Let's focus on spreading the art. Yeah.
Absolutely, you're absolutely correct, right? But it has the age-old problem of just like when you learn a language, you can learn a lot of words, you can learn a lot of phrases, like they do in high school when they teach you, you know, a language. That doesn't mean you're learning a language, right? You're getting introduced to it, but if you actually try to go to that country and speak it, oh, good luck, right? You're too much thinking
exactly.
Involved, right? So what happened to me in Santa Cruz then, as I was going up to working towards my black belt, is that the gentleman showed up, an older gentleman, probably about what age that I am right now, called himself Sifu Louis and started teaching classes. My instructor knew who, you know, Doug McLeod knew who he was, but then we knew Sifu Louis was not his real name. He was really intense. Turned out it was Tino Twiolo Sega.
Oh, very nice.
So I happened to be lucky enough to be in his class. It was over a year that I was in his class. So there was only like, I think, 12 of us in his class. So. And the interesting side story to why he was there, and people say there was a hit out on him and all this kind of stuff. Here's what actually happened. At least I'm going to give you one different view of that. One of the guys that studied also with Douglas McLeod was David Ray. I don't know if he still studies or not, but I knew him and he taught me some techniques early on, right? He was ahead of me in belt rank. David Ray went to high school with a lady, I believe it was Adele was her first name, the woman that eventually was married to Tino Twiolo Sega.
Okay.
And had his kids. She was from Santa Cruz. She grew up in Santa Cruz, and that's where then, you know, Tino Twiolo Sega ended up. So my theory is that was the main reason why he was there. But, you know, stories get exaggerated and get changed in such things, right? And so that was my path towards, you know, getting to my black belt. And then as I got my black belt, I opened a school together with Douglas McLeod in Salinas, California. That was 1984. And make a long story short, I was running the school while Douglas McLeod was showing up every once in a while.
Yeah, I can relate to that in my, my capoeira journey. I basically ended up inheriting our group, our school, in that the head instructor had a habit of, you know, come summertime, he would just disappear and not call, not tell anybody who's running class. And so, yeah, I would show up to class and we would all kind of stand around looking at each other. And it's like, okay, well, who's leading class today? And it was me and another guy that had, well, there was another guy in the class that had more experience in capoeira than I did, but he was not interested in the teaching side. So he would most of the time just not be interested in taking over the class. And me at the time, I mean, I had only been doing capoeira probably 6 months, maybe at the time, maybe a little bit longer. And since he wouldn't step up, I would just take some of my Kenpo training and, you know, some of the drills and stuff that we would do. I would just go, okay, well, you know, I don't know a lot about this capoeira stuff, but, you know, I do have a little bit of Kenpo in my toolbox. So, you know, we'll just do, you know, Kenpo drills. And, and it just kind of, as we kind of went along, it was just more and more I was, you know, leading the class and right. And just kind of went from there. Oh, yeah, for sure.
To be an instructor, it's nothing like it. I think by far the best Kenpo people are the ones who also ran schools or clubs and were teaching all their lives, right? And you can use your students sort of as like guinea pigs, right? And you can work out with these students, right? So opening the school in Salinas did something similar to me. First of all, I was teaching all the time, but also it put me in direct contact with Ed Parker. Because I'm the one who doing all the orders and everything and talking to him, right? So then that led me to Mr. Parker's doorstep, right? And that was, to me, it was sort of like a kid in the candy store, right? Mm-hmm. Especially because shortly before that, when I was just barely a green belt or brown belt, I saw the old movie with Ed Parker.
Yeah.
Right, well, he's one of the seven assassins, right? And the fighting scene he has with Tino Twiolo Sega in the high-rise building where he throws Tino out the window, right? So
yeah,
I saw because back then we already had cable TV. I don't know if you remember that, but it was in like the early 80s, right? And then to be able to actually study with both of them, to me, that was just, it was almost weird, right? Especially just coming from Santa Cruz and then going to Salinas, you know, those things, those two towns are like, you know, an hour away from each other. And then, you know, of course, I didn't study in Salinas with Mr. Parker. I had to drive to Pasadena to do that. But still, you know, to be connected like that, that was something that was, I'm very glad that that happened because it opened a lot of doors for me. And then I went out on my own. By 1987, I had my own first school. And then I opened a total of 4 schools, which I ran throughout the entire 90s. Right? And then in the 2000s, I started closing some of them down and just focused on the Fresno school. Mm-hmm. And I still teach 4 days a week at the Fresno school, but I only teach the brown and black belts, the advanced class, right? Because my son Randy, who's now 30 years old, is first of all, he's a really, really good Kenpo black belt. He's probably in my lineage, second or third most qualified instructor that I have, even though he's, you know, that's not an 8th degree or anything because of his age. But he started when he was 10 years old and he never missed a day. And that's just, this is not an exaggeration. He never missed a day, right? So he's been like working constantly. He does, you know, he teaches all the time right now. He runs a school. That's where he's at right now, together with my wife, Renee. They are running the school right now while I'm actually at the house right here talking to you.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
And I do because, you know, one of the things that I do in order to help Mr. Parker's system to preserve it is to make it available online quite a bit. So I have students in different countries. I have students in Mexico. I have students in South America, like Venezuela, for example, or Chile or Peru, and a couple other countries. I have students in Europe from Italy to Spain to Netherlands. Right? So I do teach quite a bit on Zoom because Zoom has made that possible, right? And one of the things that I'm committed to is to teach Mr. Parker's system without altering it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a traditionalist. What it means is that Mr. Parker worked his entire life, what it means to me, is that Mr. Parker worked his entire life on refining his system. And I would say that there is still a good 20% of his knowledge and wisdom that hasn't even gotten out to most of the Kenpo community yet. And so what happens, it's an inevitable thing that will happen, is that somebody has learned all the material, but they're on the first phase of memorizing it. That's the first thing you do, right? And then they have difficulty making some techniques work. That's inevitable in Ed Parker's Kenpo. The basics in Ed Parker's Kenpo are unique, right? You're learning looping strikes and chopping punches, and most people don't even know what that is. And so they think it's something really weird and exotic, which it's not. It is simply Ed Parker's Kenpo, in a nutshell, gives you an incredible street advantage via a small number of concepts. Now, there's a huge number of concepts that we'll add, but the main thing is, like I was saying earlier, one thing is you always want to keep your opponent in check, which means you want to prevent your opponent from being able to execute any of his or her options, right? And part of that is checking him or her. The other part is intercepting them, which is really just another way of checking, right? If you think of the hand sword and 5 swords, or the same thing with the raking back, knuckle, and shielding hammer, the exact same idea, right? It is a strike that is somewhat unique. Think of the shielding hammer idea. Mm-hmm. Most people, if they're doing an extended outward block with their front arm, would prefer to do a rear hand punch. Right? Because that's, first of all, that's my other arm, right? So it's waiting to hit, right? Plus, the probability of success is lower compared to the raking back knuckle. Or you can even make that a hammer fist or a hand sword to the side of the neck, right? Because you're following the guy's arm. Right? And you're striking from an angle that he is probably not prepared to block or protect. So we're using a path of least resistance as part of that. That's part of the stimuli that's causing you to choose that particular strike, right? And we're choosing the strike that has the highest probability of success. And it has that, just like I explained a moment ago, because of availability and his, you know, inability to block it and protect the target, but also because of distance. We are so close to that target, you know, that it's easy to reach. It is easy to strike faster with our raking back knuckle than what he can with his second arm. Right? So really good interception. So Ed Parker's Kenpo is probably the prime example of getting a strategic advantage by knowing the best counter in any given moment, all right? And that's what you usually want to look for in your techniques. How you know you understand one of Mr. Parker's techniques when you can answer the question, why is this next strike the best strike? And it should always have those qualities. It should always be, well, it should be intercepting anything that he has available to strike with. It should be preventing him further, maybe like a body manipulation. And you should be able to do it without looking. That's what most of the Kenpo community misses, that part. Yeah. This is a multiple attacker art. My chances of surviving a multiple attacker scenario are zero if I don't see the next guy coming.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The idea of being able to scan my environment briefly while I'm hitting is extremely valuable and a very, very, a great strategic advantage. A lot of Kenpo black belts have never been taught that. So then they go, you know what? I don't like this technique. Let me change it. Because they often don't understand that that particular strike has that purpose. So now they're changing the technique without those concepts present. They have just watered down Kenpo. And Facebook has brought this to my attention. I never thought this was going to be an issue. Yeah. Facebook, right? And I was resistant towards Facebook. At first, I didn't want to be on it, but then I saw my wife on it, right? And so I looked at the Kenpo community and I looked at what they were saying, right? And the Kenpo community going like, hang on, these guys, like, they got it wrong, right? They are criticizing Ed Parker's Kenpo. Sometimes you hear these statements, I'm sure you've read them yourself, about like, well, the techniques, Mr. Parker developed these techniques back in the 60s and 70s, and so they're outdated now. To me, that's absolute nonsense. How is an elbow outdated? Right? I mean, if you really think about it, you can talk in generalities, you can get away with saying such a thing about, you know, these techniques are outdated. Well, no, let's take it one thing at a time. The chop, is it outdated? The palm or the eye strike, is that outdated? The elbow, is that outdated? Whatever technique you're talking about doesn't matter, right? What's outdated is the idea, or what actually has been proven to be not practical, is the idea of being able to memorize the technique sequence and then hope that a single stimulus from our opponent can then be the trigger for our technique sequence, and we no longer have to do anything until we're done with the technique, except to blindly execute the sequence. Has been demonstrated to be completely not, practical, right? That never was practical to begin with, and Mr. Parker never tried to claim that it was. That's why he has the ideal phase, the what-if phase, the formulation phase, right? Family grouping and such things, right? So unfortunately, those types of training are not prevalent enough. I'm sure you looked at different martial arts, different Kenpo schools. Ask, as a general habit, ask people, okay, can you tell me what the definition of the formulation phase is? And most people cannot. Seasoned black belts often cannot. They often get it mixed up with, that's when I do whatever I think is the best move at a time. No, that's free reacting. Not a bad thing to do. Often that is a good test of your skills. But that's not a training stage of developing specific reactions. If all I want to do is develop, let's say, that downward hand sword at the end of five swords, telling you to do anything won't get me to that result. Now, if I tell you, attack me with, let's say, right punches, left punches, I'm just going to block and hit you with single strikes or sometimes double strikes, but every once in a while, bend over, like you're going to tackle me or something. So that I can see whether I'm ready to, I got to move for that. I got that downward chop I could use. Or I could turn it into charging ram and hit you with that left outward heel pump parry, right? Just before, right? So very, very related, right?
Exactly.
So if I relate it to other moves and I've worked them as a group, like a family group, now I have actually a very specific means of incorporating, of developing that one reaction to this one specific stimulus. You bending over, presenting different targets, which would surprise most people, but in practice we can use it, right? Now, a lot of schools don't do this kind of training. And then that ruins our, first of all, that ruins Kenpo by itself, because then somebody will get the wrong impression of the, you know, the usefulness of it, right? So that's the long way to say that my commitment is completely towards preserving Mr. Parker's system, because a lot of people have the wrong perception of what it actually teaches or how much it teaches.
Yeah.
How big of a strategic advantage it actually offers. One of the things I had the benefit of doing when I was, the same time that I had my first school open and same time as studying with Mr. Parker, was I worked in security. I got into fights all the time because it was I was just catching shoplifters, right? At a major department store, right? And back then, you were allowed to chase them down and catch them and bring them back in. And so my tools were a badge and a pair of handcuffs. And that was it. Other than that, plain clothes. So I don't look very intimidating in plain clothes. So I had a lot of people resist when I, you know, went to arrest them. So for me to use, you know, to go on the ground, to fight somebody who just wanted to get away, but also to fight somebody who was desperate, because a lot of people that are really good shoplifters are also tend to be addicted to a drug. But that's why they're going in there to steal a lot of stuff, right? So that's something that, you know, it was a great advantage to me because Mr. Parker was also very interested in that. He was very fascinated by that. And to me, you know, that just meant that I was studying a system not only that worked in that situation very well, but also from a guy that was fascinated by how I was applying it in real life. And the experience to me was just priceless. But I think what it really caused me to do is the effect it caused, it made me understand Kenpo better. And I learned the hard way too. You know, the way I learned not to get taken down to the ground is by being taken down to the ground a couple of times.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all make mistakes, and I made mistakes. Fortunately, I survived them all. But it's kind of like doing a point fight, right? There's certain things you don't think about, and you make a big mistake in a point fight. And if you're lucky enough to have filmed yourself, you look at the video afterwards and go like, I can't believe I fell for that. And then that's when you learn. That's the last time you ever made that mistake, and that's how your experience grows. Right. From that point on, nobody can ever set that trap for you again because you know how that feels like, right?
So,
So that's really those are some of the things that motivate me to really preserve Mr. Parker's system, only because I see how many people have difficulty to fully grasp the potential of Ed Parker's Kenpo. Right. I know that you guys were discussing when you were talking with Jamie Seabrook and his podcast about the influence of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, right? Or grappling in general, right? Which to me, first of all, that's what I started with. And I didn't start with Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, but worrying about somebody taking me down to the ground is what I started with, right? That reality of it, right? That nobody was going to respect my strike unless I, you know, it really worked, right? My thinking is, well, Mr. Parker designed the system to fight wrestlers and boxers, right? You have on your belt level, for example, you're working through third brown right now.
Yes.
You have two self-defense techniques. Actually, there's a total between the third brown and second brown. There's four self-defense techniques specifically designed against a boxer doing a jab cross. And circling fans is one of them. Protecting fans is one of them. Entwined maces is going to be on the next belt level is one of them. And unfurling crane is one of them. And when you know how to connect them with each other, you realize, oh, okay, that's either odd stance or even stance where, you know, against somebody who's doing a jab and a cross, right? And by the same token, Mr. Parker was designed many techniques to deal with a grappler. But you have to be comfortable with the grappling attacks. And you have to know at what point certain parts of your technique, certain nuances have to be emphasized more. Right? So that means you have to be familiar. You have to be presented with the stimulus more often. That's all it means, right? Most of the time, look at, like, say, in Kenpo, see if you can get a picture in your mind. If I tell you, imagine a Kenpo technique line, or I don't know, blue belts, right? And they're working on like charging ram, technique against a tackle. And tell me what you perceive as the quality of the tackles by all these Kenpo guys. Are they doing good tackles?
No, they're kind of, you know, like you mentioned before, they're kind of like, oh, well, I know how this is going to end. So let me just kind of, you know, make it easy on myself. And
exactly. Yeah, there's. So to add to that, that, you know, how much time does the instructor really spend on explaining to you what a good tackle is like, right?
Yeah.
And plus, even if you did know, let's say you were a football player before and your Kenpo instructor says, do a tackle. Are you really going to attempt to take your instructor and knock him on the ground hard on his back? Right?
No,
most of the time, we're too respectful to that. We're even less, we know that's not okay, right? And then, that's what makes our training unrealistic, is because we often neglect to improve the attacks. Right? As we get better and better with the techniques, we should improve the attack more and more, right? And that's another area that is weak in camp four, but it's not understandably weak because, okay, you have to be good, not just with, you know, strikes and pushes and grappling and knife attacks and club attacks and, you know, and holding a gun like somebody would. You have to know all those realistic attitudes of using all those attacks. And that takes a long time, right? So all those are factors that I have learned, and you know, in my couple of decades of training in Kenpo, that's where we're going wrong. So when it comes to, for example, the subject of mixing Kenpo with Jiu-Jitsu, not that it's wrong. You can do that. You can mix Kenpo with a lot of systems, right? But then it's going away a lot of times from what Mr. Parker is teaching. Now, I would argue, though, because we do have second contingency in within the Kenpo community that's also in law enforcement, there it makes more sense, right? If you're a cop, you don't want to be, you remember Rodney King, the videotape? Okay, right, that's not the kind of cop you want to be, right?
No.
And certainly you don't want to be filmed.
Yeah, for sure.
So using regular Kenpo, Ed Parker's Kenpo as a cop, there's a problem there, right? There's like, well, I can't just, you know, break bones just because the guy is drunk, right? Mm-hmm. He's not complying, right? So then knowing a variety of restraining movements is a real necessity. But, and also the danger is different. When I'm a cop, I probably have at least one more cop right behind me or next to me, right? Mm-hmm. So it's okay to go to the ground, right? Because now that does away with the danger of multiple opponents, right? Same thing with the bouncer, the exact same thing. A bouncer typically has some backup, and the guy that you're kicking out, you still want him to come back next Saturday to sell them more alcohol.
Right? Yeah.
So your boss isn't going to want you. Your boss isn't going to want you to really injure his patrons, right? So then it makes sense to mix Kenpo with Jiu-Jitsu.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a 140-pound woman walking down the street and there's three guys coming at you, I would argue, nah, you're better off using Ed Parker's Kenpo. That is now the more effective system, right?
Yeah.
For me, I always identified, but even though I did security for many years, I kind of felt I had that one under control, right? And plus, how often am I going to do that again? Unless I'm working security, I'm not really going to go around and have to restrain a lot of people, right? But I might have to defend myself against a group of people. And that's why I focus on Ed Parker's original Kenpo, because that's what, you know, that system teaches. That's what Mr. Parker was completely focused on survival. Highest probability of success, even when there's multiple opponents, even when they have weapons. So I forgot how I got onto the subject, other than just talking Kenpo. That's why I tend to drift towards when you talk to me about.
That's why we're here. I love it. I love that perspective, and I definitely think there are more, teachers, students of Kenpo that, you know, don't think about those angles of, what it is that we're doing, I say all the time, that a lot of people are focused on the how and not so much the why. And
I think we
need a lot more thinking about the why in order to, improve ourselves, not just in Kenpo, but any art, anything that you're doing. You got to know why you're doing it.
Imagine a musician who learns all these different blues phrases and then doesn't know what key the band is playing.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, if you don't have the perception, then you cannot have the actual output either, right?
Exactly.
That's really the problem, right? I think the biggest problem, it's not just we, but all other martial arts that have any kind of memorization process have the same issue. And it can be summed up in three words. Ready, fire, aim.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a natural human tendency to shoot all kinds of stuff out there before you actually are fully perceiving it. And that's why also I am actually an advocate of point fighting,
mm-hmm.
even though it has clearly has its limitations, right?
Yeah.
But I love fighting at the IKCs. I did quite well. I got a lot of first places with it. But at the same time, I was also, arresting people in the street. So I had a balance, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what point fighters are extremely good at is perceptual speed and setting traps
mm-hmm.
and controlling distance. If you look at the champions, a true champion that continues to be a champion, not just in point fighting, boxers are the same. They create a situation that they can reasonably predict. Right? So they kind of know what the opponent is probably going to do before the opponent even knows it. Right.
Exactly.
The best example is, right, if we're in an even stance and I come at you with a back knuckle to the head and a punch to the ribs. My goal is not to hit you with the back knuckle, right? My goal is to hit you with the punch to the ribs as soon as you take the bait.
For sure.
And that's a really good one. That move by itself, by the way, can win you more point fights if you become a master at that move, right?
Yeah, you know, I didn't have much of a competing career, but in my limited competing capacity, yeah, the back knuckle reverse punch was was definitely the go-to in many situations.
And people don't realize that that's also part of Parker's training, though, right? And because he talked about depth perception, height perception, and width perception. That was the wrong choice of words. Depth deception. Height deception and width deception, and the point fighter uses primarily depth deception. In other words, they're lying to you in a way intentionally about when they're going to get to you. The more seasoned the person is, the more they do that. Boxers do it, but instead of shuffling back and forth, they bend back and forth. They use their upper body to do it, right? Because they don't have to worry about certain attacks. So if I know all you're allowed to do is use punches, then I don't actually need to shuffle. I can just kind of shift my weight back, right, and bend back a little bit. But exactly the same purpose, right? I'm going to make you think I'm coming at you, then I'm going to make you miss, and then I'm going to hit you, right, when you went for the bait, right? But again, it's perception. Right? There is a deception, of course. I'm going to trick you to make you think that I'm hitting you on three. One, two, three. And I'm really going to hit you on two. Or some, you know, variants of that, right? So that's your first level of control. In other words, the first thing I can do before we even touch is make you hit at my ghost image. Right? And that's why I think Mr. Parker named it that, ghost imaging, right? And most people in Kempo would be aware of ghost imaging in terms of width deception. That's how they got that concept explained. You know, like the idea of turning your body very quickly and slipping off to the side, let's say reversing maze, where you move your back foot up the circle, right? That's a really easy way to explain to a Kempo person what ghost imaging is, right? But because you want to find out, can I really set up a situation that, you know, can I set up a trap for my opponent that they're just going to walk into because of the human tendency of ready, fire, aim?
Exactly.
And so the way that Mr. Parker then gave us an additional advantage is by now, once you're in, notice Kempo techniques stay in and they get very close, and the higher belt of a technique you're training, the closer it gets. Because now I can use my sense of touch. Now I can feel your intention. And now I can find the targets on you without having to look. Because after all, I got to scan my environment still. Right? And by the same token, what is the average person's skill of being bumped up body to body and still being able to hit hard? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Most people naturally start grabbing and wrestling because that's, you know, I need some room, because most people think of depth more in order to generate force, right? Not so much about height and width, right? So not only when we are able to strike using height and width, locking horns is a great example of height, right? Just coming up. Most people wouldn't think of that, right? And there's, you know, a gazillion examples of using width, you know, striking more left and right, you know, in order to generate force and power, right? Okay? Most people wouldn't be ready to do that, right? Most people would want to create some distance. So not only do we get better at finding additional choices that way, but we are fighting in an arena, or we're fighting in the circumstances that our opponent has a disadvantage. An untrained person isn't going to be able to do that. Right? But exactly. If we're boxing, then it's kind of 50-50 in terms of probability of success and strategic advantage, right? I'm pretty sure that my, you know, whoever I fight, they've practiced some boxing on their own. They got that idea. They know what they might do, right? But once we're that close in, that all changes, right? So I would fully expect my opponent to want to go into wrestling or grappling once I get in close. But every Kempo counter is designed to prevent that from happening and to let you walk into the next strike and the next strike, right? So again, I would argue that a lot of Kempo people don't fully see that. And so then that causes people to say Kempo needs an evolution. My counter argument to that would be Mr. Parker's techniques don't need evolution. The way we practice his techniques is what needs an evolution. The memorization was the first step, so you know what it is that you're supposed to be practicing. But you cannot develop spontaneity in a vacuum. In other words, I cannot practice a single strike in terms of spontaneity. I can practice two strikes or more and switch and decide. You know, in other words, I could come at you square on, I could come at you sideways, and you can now practice what the best strike is for each one of those two scenarios. And that would be the first time you're working mental speed, if we're taking a step up from working the ideal phase, right? If you know how I'm going to come at you before I come at you, you don't have to make any decision at all, right? That's where Kenpo is at, right? So, but that's not just Kenpo, yeah? Kenpo has a solution, right? Most other systems don't even have a solution for that. They think, oh, yeah, that's how it's going to go down, right? In Kenpo, we have another technique that would be then taking its place if the opponent changes something, right? But to just discuss it isn't enough. You have to train yourself, right, at a subconscious level. So in other words, I got to surprise you with it, right? But it has to be a controlled workout. In other words, maybe we do three of these. I come at you square, then next time I come at you with my right side more forward, then the next time I come at you with my left side more forward, and you're just working your first counter strike. That's all you're going to do. And already you need now three different strikes. And you're learning three different speeds, right? And that's what you're going to be able to reread this also. I'm sure you've been taught this already in Mr. Parker's Infinite Insights into Kenpo. We have to have perceptual speed, physical speed, and mental speed. In other words, we have to be faster at knowing what's coming, perceptual speed, which is a matter of familiarity. If I've never seen a tackle, I'm not going to react early to it. If I've never seen a roundhouse kick, I won't react early. So that's just the more familiar, the more often you're throwing a roundhouse kick towards my head, the sooner I'm going to start reacting to it and recognize it, right? And then the physical speed is what we're good at. That has more to do with just physical attributes. You know, do you have a proper, is he move efficient? Are you moving from point of origin to his final destination in the best manner? Do you have good alignment and do you have good timing, right? That we're good at, right? But mental speed, most people don't even answer the question, okay, what is it that you're doing quickly, mentally? What does it mean? And most people don't go far enough to actually analyze that, right? They're thinking, I'm creating something a lot of times. I'm coming up with something. Well, you are selecting. You are choosing. That's what mental speed means. Selecting more rapidly. Do I use A or B or D or E or F and so on, right? Mm-hmm. So that needs a specific practice. And it can easily become overwhelming. If I attack you in 10 different ways, you're not going to be able to remember all 10 different responses. Heck, I won't even be able to remember the 10 different attacks. That's too much when we're going set, right? That's too much. It's overwhelming. So then we often don't do it at all. But if we do just three or four, then we can pull it off, right? And so that's a matter of having the right gradient and knowing at what point it becomes overwhelming and having a controlled means of practicing in order to then, you know, bring a move from conscious knowledge, oh, I know what I should do, to a subconscious reaction, right? So memorization isn't going to give us that speed, right? It has to become a subconscious response. And that's, then, you know, that's the other area where the Kenpo community can do a lot of improving, in my view, right? So that's where I come from. That's what I'm dedicated to. That's why I offer the teach Ed Parker's Kenpo without having to change it, because my view is this. Well, before you fix all these problems that we have in our training, before you go to some other system of martial arts, shouldn't you like finish what you got?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before you think of even more choices, shouldn't you get better at choosing between the ones you already got, right?
Exactly.
I haven't finished that process yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's the area that I hope to influence the Kenpo community in more. And I think I prioritize that a lot simply because I saw what happened about 20 years ago or so when I saw Facebook developing and social media developing and more people saying, oh, well, Kenpo, Ed Parker's techniques need to be updated. His techniques are outdated. And I'm thinking, no. His techniques aren't outdated. You have not updated your knowledge of Kenpo, right? There's more that you can do. You're probably guilty of the same thing we all were guilty of at first. You're memorizing material and then wondering why it's not working for you.
Exactly.
I know that's a lot I'm throwing out there, but I think the whole thing needs to be viewed as a package like that, because in the absence of being able to communicate that to the public, I'm not so sure about the survival of Campbell. And I think in some ways it can be very helpful to be simplistic, showing how this counter, this hand sword to the throat, for example, is faster than his second punch. And let's measure it. Let's show it, right? It's an arduous process, right? It's going to take a long time before we get to all the different strikes, but we don't have to get to everything, right? We just got to demonstrate like a bunch of different strikes and say, that's what Kempo does. It's ultimate interception. And, you know, at the same time, it is an art that teaches us to develop power in very short distances, right? We can be so close to our opponent and get powerful strikes, but not for the benefit of choosing our most powerful strike, but with the thought in mind of using the one that has the greatest chance of being delivered, highest probability of success. So that's why I stress those concepts a lot, because those are the ones people don't think about. All right? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
As you can see, I can talk about this all day long.
I could listen. I could listen forever. So we'll definitely have to do a part two, part three, part 57 as we go along here. To kind of head towards the finish line for today, I've got a few little fun questions here to kind of throw at you. Uh-huh. So first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Well, no. And the simple, it would be the equivalent of asking somebody who's speaking or learning another language, do you have a favorite phrase? No, I need them all. And depending on the situation, no. If you give me an attack, then I can tell you a favorite technique.
Okay.
Starting position, right? If I'm in a certain position, you're in a certain, doing a certain attack, I can immediately tell you what my favorite technique is now, right? But in general, no, I don't. I would say favorite concepts. And those are the ones I just talked about for the last half hour.
I like it. Great answer. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
No, I think my view towards that is, first of all, right off the bat, having seen the way Mr. Parker developed the system and having had access to his computer also after he passed away, right? Mrs. Parker relied heavily on me after Mr. Parker passed away, right? Which is also how I made myself enemies in the Kempo community, by the way, right?
Yeah, so, I can imagine.
I supported Mrs. Parker not because I thought she necessarily was the best to handle it all, even though she did a really good job. But I'm thinking, well, it's either her or nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to follow any one of the other choices, right? If she does it, and she kind of kept herself out of the idea of trying to teach anything Campbell, she knew that was not her business, right? But one thing I noticed, the reason why I'm saying that is that, for example, nowadays people talk about long form 8. Mr. Parker never created a long form 8. Now, I know if I just say it like that, people will violently disagree, especially for instance, Larry Tatum, who I respect a lot, right? Mm-hmm. He said, no, he showed it to me. No, he showed you the knife set. Yeah, the knife set exists, even though Mr. Parker ultimately discarded it, just like he discarded the nunchaku form. Mm-hmm. Right? But he was going to create a new long form 8. He passed away before he had a chance to do it. But his journals already reflected it. Right? In the 5th degree black belt journal, he already had a section for long form 8, and it was blank. He had not done it yet, right? Because the latest form that he developed was long form 7 with the double sticks. Right? But people used to refer to the knife set as long form 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Mr. Parker actually created it as a double stick form, right, and called that long form 7 and had a whole write-up about it now, well, obviously the knife set had to be either called knife set or then, since Mr. Parker passed away and never answered the question, people started calling it long form 8, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the sets, they are all important in my view, but have an expiration date, so to speak. How much time you spend practicing blocking set these days?
Not as much as I probably should.
Right? I mean, there's only so much you can get out of doing blocking set one. But when you were a beginner, it was essential that you did.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Just like coordination set one, most of the number one sets, right? They're important. Until you are bored of them, you probably need them. One thing Mr. Parker was good with is understanding proper gradients. You can't do B until you first master A, right? So in that respect, even I'm an instructor, I've been an instructor all my life. So if I did not have short one, long one, short two, long two available, I wouldn't be able to create good students. That doesn't mean I'm still spending time working on those forms, you know, almost not at all, right, anymore, right? I know how to do it, and I can perform it if I need to. I can certainly teach it, but for me to do long form two all day long, it's going to have a very diminished return.
Gotcha.
So for advanced level, I would definitely say all of the, from number three on, are extremely important because they all contain application of movement that you actually will use, right? They are reflecting actual self-defense techniques, right? A favorite? Not really. Again, that would be just the same as saying, you know, favorite technique, you know, well, if you're choking me, it's going to probably be something out of long form three, right? If you come at me with a knife, it's going to be something out of long form six, right?
Gotcha.
All right. What else you got?
So if there's anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
I don't know. Does it matter if they're still alive or not?
Living or dead, any time period, or non-real people?
It's an interesting question. I would want to pick somebody who probably has a lot of experience. I think I would be more inclined to pick somebody like Mike Tyson or Muhammad Ali.
Nice.
Or if it's in the martial arts world, maybe Steve Muhammad Sanders, yeah. Or
yes.
Ralph Castellano. Yes. Right? Because, you know, Ralph Castellano is, you know, even though I had a chance to interact with him because I promoted his nieces to black belt, trained them and promoted them to black belt. But, you know, these are guys that are very, very good fighters and had a lot of experience with it, right? And I had my share of dealing with a lot of people that tried to wrestle me, so I'm more comfortable with them. But I think strikers a lot of times have a lot of finesse and subtleties in their movement. And I'm thinking, that's also why I went into point fighting, by the way, right? Because, and I did it at the IKCs, because I figured, like, these guys are the best. Right, and the pool of talent you have available, and how many people in the world do point fighting? Right? A lot. Right? So there is a high standard in terms of the skill you're actually dealing with. So that would be my best answer to that question.
Yeah, I like it. Those are great choices. I love it. So then the final question, in honor of Ed Parker's love of humor and jokes and whatnot, is: do you have a joke you'd like to share with us?
Mr. Parker used to share with us the joke of when he had techniques that were similar moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're comparing Thundering Hammers and the Sleeper and Dance of Death, and how the first strike is very similar. You're just changing targets, right? But it was all from the arm hanging down, right? So it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or also, you know, like we say in Kenpo, the same thing, right? and then what's he talking about? He said that this is a joke that Bruce Lee told him a long time ago about a Chinese man who had the name Tim O'Reilly. And so somebody asked him, "You're Chinese. How is your name Tim O'Reilly?" And the Chinese man goes, and now Mr. Parker would do this with a Chinese accent, right? Which is probably nowadays socially not as acceptable to replicate. But he basically said, "Well, when I came up the boat, the man in front of me was Irish man. They asked him name. He'd say, Tim O'Reilly. Then my turn. They asked me my name. Did I tell him truth? Same thing."
Oh, I love it. I love it. That is a great, great, great one.
He was he had a lot of humor. He interspersed a lot of humor in his seminars and such. Yeah, he was a crack up. He was also amazingly interested in all of us. The reason why Mr. Parker had such a strong following, right? Like at his funeral, there was about 2,000 people, right? And everybody, even if they only met Ed Parker a few times, Mr. Parker was a friend of mine. That's how he made you feel. Right, he was sincerely interested in people. And so I think the biggest, one of the things that we often miss, and so it's actually kind of nice that you're asking that question, right? What we often miss is the fact that he made us all feel very appreciated. And so for most of us, when he passed away, first of all, it was extremely surprising. Right? Because I mean, we did not think that it was happen at 59.
Yeah.
For most of us, it was almost the same as our parent dying. Right? And so that also explained a lot of the turmoil of the 90s that you apparently stepped right into. That's when you started your training, right? That was the midst of a lot of battling, right, between factions of Kempo, right? Yeah. But that was all based on we all miss a poker.
Yeah.
And it's like fighting over over dad's old memorabilia in the basement.
For sure.
So, but that was Mr. Parker's personality. It was very different from the personality that you would have expected from a grandmaster. Right? Where he made, the grandmaster trying to come across like he's the most important. Mr. Parker, if you would have went to one of Mr. Parker's seminars 1 year, and then you were just in the back row because you're a green belt, right? And then a year later, you go to another seminar of his in the area somewhere, he will recognize, he would have known your name. The moment you walked into that building, he would have said, Reggie, how you doing? And you would have been like, he remembered me. I didn't even think he noticed me. That was at Parker. Yeah.
That is a great quality to have. And it makes the world of difference to, the little doesn't leave out people. So that's a great thing. Great thing to have. Well, yeah, I thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights and your story. And I'm just overjoyed for the time that we've had today. And we'll definitely have to do some more in the future. I would say that now we're at the part where time for shameless self-promotion here. So you can, this is your time to, if there's anything you wanted to bring up that we didn't cover or anything else that you wanted to throw out there, this is your time, time for that.
The most self-promoting thing that I can say is actually more to promote Mr. Parker's system in the first place, and that is that I'm completely committed to teaching Mr. Parker's system the way that he left it and when he passed away, right? Yeah, Mr. Parker made changes to the journals all the way until the last month that he was alive. And you can, if you actually have a copy of the actual journals, which most people have some, but not all of them, and most people don't know if they have an authentic version or not, right? But I was in the position, a very fortunate position of not only having studied with Mr. Parker during the last years of his life, but also having have all the materials directly from his computer, right? Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, Mrs. Parker chronologically saved copies in previous times. So when somebody claims, oh, I also wrote parts of those journals, we knew that to be a complete falsehood, right? That's not true, because then we saw the different versions and how he developed the journals more and more, right? So my commitment is to preserve the system in that way without adding my own interpretation to it, without saying like, well, I like it when we do this, when we change a strike right here, right? That's not what I think my true contribution, potential contribution probably should be focused on, because I am in this unique position. I'm not the only one, but the rest of the guys didn't do it.
Yeah.
There's a great tendency of, I want to have my own type of Kempo, and, nothing wrong with that at all, right? Larry Tatum does a great job with that. He shows kind of like to the world how you can tailor the system and change it a little bit. And he's sticking to Kempo while he's tailoring. He's not going and using other arts to mix it in, right?
Yeah.
So, but with me, I go like, I think the best service I can do to the world of Kempo is there's always going to be new Kempo black belts out there that are going to want to know, well, how that Mr. Parker originally designed this. And that's what I'm 100% committed to help people with that. That's why I have people in different countries. I teach, you're just like the fourth session today that I'm dealing with, because I teach over Zoom, every day. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. A lot of countries have different time zones, so I just do some of it in the morning, some of it at night. And I'm definitely receiving feedback from people that are thinking the same. So people that really want the original Ed Parker's Kempo, the way he left it, and when he passed away, I refer to 1987 simply because that's when he copyrighted his last set of manuals. Okay. Right? That's why it's referred to as 1987. Doesn't mean it stopped at 1987. It went on until December 1990, until he passed away. But the reason why I focus on that is because a lot of people want that. And there are people, and I believe that those people will contribute a lot to the survival of Ed Parker's Kempo, because I can't imagine that there's not going to be more people in the future that go like, well, can I learn the original first? Even if I do want to change it, how do I know what to change if I don't know the original?
Exactly.
So that would be my shameless promotion of anybody who wants to participate in the survival of Kempo, let me know, because I'm interested in helping other people do that. Because there's no way I can do that by myself, right? Mm-hmm. I can do a lot, but right now I'm heavily focused on developing a small group of people. I probably have about 10 black belts internationally that I put my time in, because they are dedicated to practicing, right? So I'm not the place to go to, like, well, sometimes like an association, because somebody mm-hmm. goes and joins the association because they want to be able to have, you know, the name recognition, and they want to have the certificate on the wall, and they want to get their mm-hmm. next rank, but they don't necessarily want to practice that much. I'm only interested in people who go like, I really want to know how the technique goes.
Exactly.
And I'm
exactly.
willing to practice every day. Those people I help, right? And I will continue to help. And I'm doing that also with the help of my son, Randy. If he wasn't running the school all the time, I wouldn't be able to do it. If he didn't know the whole system, I wouldn't be able to do it, because I need somebody to practice on, right? He's not the only person I have, but he is probably one of the two best black belts I have in terms of knowing the entire system, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then I have a whole network, my whole school and everything that all makes all that possible. And my wife, Renee, helps making that possible, because right now, like I said, right now she's over there teaching and making sure we have not only a successful school, but in 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a new generation of black belts still that's going to, again, help us with that, right? So that would be my only thing. That's the only thing that I'm interested in nowadays. You know, it's really just, all right, you want to, you know, help preserve Mr. Parker's system? I can help you with that. If you're sincere and honest, right, to me, that's worth putting my energy in.
I like it. Well, yes, thank you again so much for your time. We will, I can't wait to get this out to the masses to hear. And thank you again so much for your.
You're very welcome. I think you're doing a really good thing with this, right? And so that's why I said right up at the beginning that, you know, I think that you are bound to create more unity. Because when you start listening to somebody else and hear their viewpoint, a lot of times you start agreeing with 90% of what they're saying. You start realizing you have a lot in common, right?
Yeah.
And plus, it does away with the social media tendency of becoming negative.
Yeah.
I know it's probably a lot of work on your part to make sure that, you know, you make a schedule available. And so I appreciate what you're doing very much. I think it's actually going to do a lot of good. So I hope you will continue doing that.
Yeah, no, that's the hope. That's the hope.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that you are in the middle of working towards your black belt, I think adds to that, because you can add a viewpoint that most people probably wouldn't be able to add. I would just say keep it up, and I want to, you know, let you know that I appreciate anybody who helps out with Mr. Parker's system surviving, and that, you know, you have a good way of contributing to that final goal.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Reggie. Have a good day.
Bye.